Lecture 10, Law and Spirit.
The Western world has effectively absorbed the Hellenistic distinction between body and spirit, and also between law and spirit. Rabbinic Judaism presents a very different understanding, whereby the spirit requires a concrete container in order to materialize in this world. When we talked about the immortality of the soul, in the Bible, the soul isn't some kind of separate entity that can exist without the body. And similarly, in Rabbinic Judaism, the spirit of the law requires the law itself in order to materialize in a concrete way in this world. So this lecture, we're going to look at several different kinds of laws within the Torah and see how they were developed in the Talmud and also by the medieval commentators. At the very end of the lecture, we're also going to get a touch of Talmud, so you can feel like you've been introduced not just to the terms, but to the structure of the Talmud as well. We're going to start by looking at a mitzvah that has been repeated over and over and over as an example of Hebrew justice. Now, it's usually not called Jewish justice. It's usually called an example of Hebrew justice. And so that may be true, but even scholars question whether or not this mitzvah that I'm about to share with you should really be understood literally, namely, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Scholars debate whether, even in its original ancient Near Eastern context, it meant what it seems to literally imply. But the rabbis already in the Mishnah had a very different understanding of how to apply that law in practice. In the Gemara, all kinds of questions are asked about that law. Well, what happens if someone with only one eye gouges out one of your two eyes? If you were to do to them what they did to you and take out their last remaining eye, you would be blinding them. Well, that's not fair. That's not equitable. That's not equal treatment. Another question. What if someone partially blinds you? How can you be sure to partially blind him to the same degree? Good question. The rabbis didn't read the Torah literally. They read it literarily, as literature. And the rabbis of the Mishnah understood that an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, meant monetary compensation. If you take out somebody's eye or take out somebody's tooth or do physical harm to them in any way, short of killing them, then you need to provide compensation in terms of money for all kinds of different things, for their doctor bills, for the opportunity cost of them being out of work, for any kind of emotional distress. Let's say that you injure the person's face and it causes trauma. So there's a list of different kinds of damages that the person who has committed the transgression is responsible for, but it all has to do with monetary compensation. And that's very typical. The Mishnah will give you the law. The law is monetary compensation. And then the Gemara will explain the reasoning behind the Mishnah and why the Mishnah didn't read that law literally, but rather read it literarily as literature. And so it's in the Gemara that we find what happens if you've got only one eye and what happens if you only partially blind the person. The way I think about the relationship between the Mishnah and the Gemara is that the Mishnah is about law, and the Gemara is about jurisprudence or legal philosophy, the reasons behind the law. So that was an example of a mitzvah that obtains between human beings. Yes? That's one very common kind of mitzvah. Mitzvot ben adam lechavero, as we say in Hebrew, a mitzvah that obtains between a human being and his fellow. Let's take a look at another such mitzvah in the same category. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against your countrymen. This goes back to Leviticus 19, a chapter that we had a chance to look at in greater detail a few lectures ago. So one question that the rabbis ask is, how can you possibly command someone not to bear a grudge? That's an emotion, and how can you command an emotion? Again, a good question. How can you command someone to feel a certain way? So what the rabbis do in their interpretation of that mitzvah is they translate the emotional state into an action. And here's the example they give. You ask to borrow someone's hatchet, and he refuses. But on the next day, he comes to you to borrow a sickle. And you say to him, here it is, I'm not like you, who wouldn't lend to me. This is called bearing a grudge, because the individual retains enmity in his heart, although he does not actually avenge himself. So bearing a grudge has an internal component, but it is expressed through behavior. The rabbis, after all, were uncomfortable about legislating emotions, but they weren't uncomfortable at all about legislating behavior. Another example, not from the Torah, but from the Mishnah, within this general category of laws between human beings. The example actually is about an inheritance law. There are a couple of inheritance laws mentioned in the Torah, but as I've said, the Torah is not an exhaustive legal code. It's a mistake to talk about the Torah as law. There's lots of laws that aren't included, and there's lots of portions of the Torah that aren't law. So what the Mishnah comes to do is to try to fill in some of those legal holes. So here's a very nice Mishnah that says, a dying man who wrote over all his property to others as a gift, but left himself a piece of land of any size whatsoever, his gift is valid. If he did not leave himself a piece of land of any size whatsoever, his gift is not valid. So what's going on there? The rabbis feel empowered to nullify someone's gift on their deathbed? What's the problem here? The rabbis understand that the person who was of sound mind, right? And it's a determination not that the doctors make, but that the rabbis make through this legal mechanism. A person who was of sound mind would not gift over all of his property, but would consider the possibility of an unlikely recovery. And in the event of an unlikely recovery, the person needs to have something for themselves. In other words, a person of sound mind wouldn't do that. So what we see from this is that justice, from the rabbi's perspective, is sometimes served by paternalism, even at the expense of a written agreement. There's another area of Jewish law that doesn't have a traditional name. This is true. But in contemporary Jewish circles, especially those of us who are connected with environmental activism, we describe this category of commandments as mitzvot between humans and their world. It turns out that the next category that we're going to look at is called mitzvot bein adam lemakom, commandments between human beings and the place. The place is a rabbinic euphemism or a rabbinic name for God. So that group of laws actually refers to the ritual commandments. But some people, particularly my wife, she thinks that we should rehabilitate that term, mitzvot between human beings and the place, to talk about these environmental laws as well, and make the place incorporate not just what it traditionally had pointed to, which was God, but also God's world and nature. A nice suggestion. Okay, so here is a law that falls into this category from the Torah. If, along the road, you chance upon a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground, with fledglings or eggs in the nest, and the mother is sitting over the fledglings or on the eggs, do not take the mother together with her young. Let the mother go. Shoo the mother away. Shiluach haken. Send the mother away. Now, why? The Torah actually gives us a reason why, so that you can continue to live for a long time on the land that the Lord your God is giving to you. Again, this idea of immortality in the Bible is about the individual's line maintaining a presence in the land of Israel. But in the Middle Ages, there were other reasons ascribed to this law that, on the face of it, is strange. Why are you shooing the mother bird away? Wouldn't you rather take the mother bird and give up the little the egg or the fledgling. There's not much meat on a fledgling. And what are you going to do with the egg once the mother bird is shooed away? So we've got a couple of responses from the medievals, and we're going to look at two of them from the medieval giants, Maimonides, who we've mentioned. He consistently argues that the human being is not the center of the universe. Maimonides does not take an anthropocentric view of the Torah. We might be the pinnacle of creation, but we're just one creature amongst God's entire creation, and we're not entitled to do anything we want. We must take into account the feelings of God's other creatures who have intrinsic rights. Other animals, from Maimonides, have intrinsic rights. This idea in Judaism is called Sa'ar Ba'alei Chaim, the distress of living creatures. And it's an overarching mitzvah not to cause pain to other living creatures, right? Unless you have a very good reason to do so. For instance, animal experimentation for medical purposes. For cosmetic purposes, that's not a good enough reason for most rabbis. But for medical experimentation that can help save human beings, that is a good reason. So this law of Tsa'ar Ba'alei Chaim is plastic, and it is dependent on the judgment of the individual rabbi whom receives the question. Nachmanides, who we've mentioned before in this course, is writing 80 years after Maimonides, and he's not writing in the Muslim part of the world, but in the Christian part of the world, in Gerona, Spain. He argues that if we show compassion to animals, it will instill in us even greater compassion toward human beings. So the reason behind the commandment isn't that we're nice to animals because the animals have some kind of rights, but if we're nice to animals, all the more will we be nice to human beings. God's concerned about us. Nachmanides is very anthropocentric. And then he adds kind of a zinger to argue against Maimonides. He says, yeah, Maimonides, after all, had God been concerned about the feelings of animals, the Torah would not have allowed for animal slaughter. Right? We're not talking about animal sacrifices. Maybe God wanted that for God's own reasons. But if the Torah, if God was so concerned about the welfare of animals, then why weren't we commanded to be vegetarians? So Nachmanides has a rejoinder for Maimonides. Okay, here's another law from the Torah that falls under this broad category of mitzvot between the human being and her place. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 20. When in your war, right? We're on a war footing here. When in your war against a city, you have to besiege it a long time in order to capture it. You must not destroy its trees, wielding the axe against them. You may eat of them, but you must not cut them down. Deforestation is prohibited by the Torah. And sometimes the Israeli defense forces in the West Bank cut down olive trees, they say because there are Palestinian snipers firing behind those olive trees. But folks in the religious world, some folks in the religious world in Israel and also in America, and folks outside of the religious world, tense up when Israel cuts down these trees because it's such a direct contradiction to this mitzvah that we have in the Torah, which obtains even on a war footing. You would think that normally you shouldn't cut down trees unless you have a very good reason. But this is saying even in the event of war, you shouldn't cut down trees. Now, the Torah actually goes on to qualify that there are certain moments during a war when you can use trees. But this is the general mitzvah of Bal Tashchit, do not destroy. This is the Jewish law of conservation. Now, what's so interesting is that the rabbis who inherited this law, they very well could have accepted that law literally. Don't cut down trees in wartime. And they may have said, all the more, don't cut down trees in peacetime. But what they did is they scooped up that law and read it expansively. So here is their application of that law that we find in the Talmud. Whoever breaks vessels, tears garments, destroys a building, clogs up a fountain, or wastes food violates the prohibition of Baal Tashchit. So they read that law in Deuteronomy very expansively. And as I said, this is the Jewish law of conservation. When someone dies and you are present in the room, there is a mitzvah that in order to recognize that a soul has departed, you rip kriya, you rip a piece of your clothes. And the discussion in the Talmud says, well, wait a second, we're not supposed to rip clothes because that's a violation of bal tashchit, of do not destroy. So the conclusion is, you're supposed to rip clothes, but not too much, right? So eventually you can repair them. There is, by the way, one exception to that law, that if you're present in the room when someone expires, when someone makes the transition to the next world, you're supposed to tear your clothes. Doctors, right? Medical doctors who are frequently in the room when people expire, when people make that transition, they don't have to tear their clothes. Okay, let's now move to that third category of mitzvot. This is called mitzvot ben adam lemakom, mitzvot between human beings and God. Jesus was asked, what is the most important commandment in the Torah? And like a good Jew, Jesus responded not with one commandment, but with two. He said, you shall love your neighbors yourself, and you shall love the Lord your God. So let's talk about that. You shall love the Lord your God. Again, some of the rabbis were uncomfortable with that mitzvah, because what does it mean to command an emotion? So one rabbinic response, or one rabbinic interpretation of that law of loving the Lord your God, is as follows. This means that because of you, the name of heaven, God, will become beloved. When a person studies Torah, speaks gently with others, engages in fair business dealings, what do people say about him? Happy is Plony who studies Torah. How beautiful are his manners and how refined his deeds. So very subtly, what has that rabbi done? It's not about loving the Lord your God, but it's about causing others to love what God commands us to do. It changes the verb from a kind of direct action or direct emotion to a causative, but it's not causing others to love God. It's causing others to love God, to love God's actions, right? Commanding us to study Torah and be nice and fair. So you feel the tension of the rabbis being a little bit uncomfortable about commanding this emotional state. Another interpretation that is later picked up by the first systematic commentator of the Bible in the Middle Ages, Rashi, is that we should love God by showing God that we love follow the commandments lovingly. Let me say that again. That we show our love for God by following the mitzvot, the commandments, lovingly. Again, what Rashi does is he turns the verb into an adverb. It's not about loving God, but it's about doing God's commandments lovingly instead of begrudgingly. Oh, well, I've got this commandment not to eat milk and meat together, so I guess I can't have that bacon double cheeseburger, right? For a couple of reasons you can't have the bacon double cheeseburger. Rather, oh, I've got a commandment not to eat milk and meat together and not to eat pork, and I love God. I love God's commandments, and so I'm not going to do that. And I'm happy to not be doing that. There are lots of other things that God allows me to eat that are just as, that are even more nutritious, that are even more satisfying, and don't sit in my stomach the way a bacon double cheeseburger does, from what I hear from other people. Of course, I wouldn't know myself. Okay. Now, there's even a third way, right? Many interpretations of loving the Lord your God. But Maimonides says the following. What is the way to attain love of God? How do we go about loving God? When one contemplates his great and wondrous deeds and creations and sees in them his unequaled and infinite wisdom, he immediately loves and praises and exalts him. Let me translate that. For Maimonides, the way to love God is by being a scientist. The way to love God is not by doing the commandments, the way Rashi says. It's not by being a nice guy, as our first interpretation suggests, but it's by studying nature, by studying the human body, by studying the stars and astronomy, and having an appreciation for God's unequaled, unrivaled wisdom, that is in nature and in God's deeds as God operates the world. That's how we go about loving God. Maimonides is an Aristotelian, and he is an intellectual elitist. We will come back to Maimonides in a future lecture. And so you pick up that intellectual elitism. Finally, when we get to a Hasidic commentary in the 18th and 19th centuries, they say, look, God commanded us to love him in the Torah. That means we can love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. So eventually, Jewish interpretations do get back to what very well may be the contextual meaning, love. But as we can see, there are many different ways of interpreting that that provide a kind of spirit for that law. Okay, now we're moving in to what is the most difficult section of this lecture. We're going to take a look at a Mishnah and the Gemara for the Mishnah, so that you will actually have under your belts a little piece of Talmud. So here's the Mishnah. First, I'm going to read it, and then we'll unpack it together. If one was reading the Shema, which is Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 9, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might. And then a few verses afterward. You were reading that section of the Torah in the Torah. And the time for reciting the Shema arrived. If he directed kiven his mind, he fulfilled his obligation. That's the Mishnah. Okay, let's unpack it. There is a rabbinic commandment based on that section of the Torah to say the Shema in the morning and in the evening. Well, let's say that it's morning or it's evening, the time that the rabbis have commanded us to recite that section has arrived, and we're not reciting that section as part of a prayer service with a prayer book in front of us, but we're reading the Torah. That's a good thing. The rabbis think that's a good thing to be doing anyway at all times of the day, read the Torah. You happen to be reading that section of the Torah when it's appropriate for you to say that section of the Torah. The Mishnah says, if he directed his mind, kiven libo, literally it's directed his heart. But the word heart in the Bible doesn't just mean the center of your emotional life, it also means the center of your intellectual life. So that's why I'm translating this. If he directed his mind, he has discharged his obligation. So far, so good? Okay. Now let's see how the Gemara understands that, or unpacks it, or deconstructs it. This is the Gemara. We learn from this Mishnah that mitzvot, commandments, require kavanah. Kavanah means intention, thinking about what you're doing. It's said in the Mishnah, if he directed his mind, and I think the plain sense is, if when he was reading in the Bible, he directed his mind, he had the intention of fulfilling that obligation of saying the Shema either in the morning or in the evening, he's discharged his obligation. Okay, back to the Gemara. We learn from this that commandments require intention, that mitzvot require kavanah, concentration or intention. Because after all, the same voice argues, what is, if he directed his mind? That's a quote, if he directed his mind from the Mishnah. If he directed his mind toward discharging that obligation. Another voice appears in the Gemara to argue against that understanding that commandments require intention. That other voice responds, what does it mean if he directed his mind? It means to read. In other words, if the person had directed their mind to read the Torah, not necessarily to fulfill the obligation of reciting the Shema in the morning and in the evening as part of your liturgical responsibilities. So the first voice comes back to read, but the Mishnah says he was reading. The Mishnah says that the person was reading the Shema. So how could they not have intended to read if the Mishnah says they were reading? The response, which is a knockdown response, is he was proofreading. He was proofreading. In other words, there is a way to read this Mishnah, as outlandish as it may appear to us, that when the Mishnah says he was reading the section of the Torah that has the Shema in it, he wasn't really reading it to understand anything about the words, but he was proofreading to make sure that all the words were spelled correctly and that the letters weren't smushed too close together and that each letter had the appropriate number of crowns, jots and tittles, as the New Testament says, right? Those little coronets on top of some Hebrew letters. Oh, so the person didn't really have awareness of what they were reading, this response in the Gemara argues, because they weren't really reading for content, they were proofreading. Okay, I love this piece of Talmud for a couple of reasons. First of all, it shows you that just like the Mishnah rereads and reinterprets the Torah, the Gemara rereads and reinterprets the Mishnah. And this process of creative rereading, this midrashic process of creative misreading or rereading, happens at every new stage in the history of Jewish thought. So that the medievals creatively reread the Talmud, and the people in the early modern period, the Hasidic writers, creatively reread the Middle Age writings and the Talmud as well as the Bible. And then it gives us, who are in the last generation of this tradition, if not authority, at least a precedent for this kind of creative rereading of the entire tradition. It also shows you, in I think a very sensitive way, that the rabbis were concerned about overburdening their community. So that although kavanah, although intention, awareness, consciousness is ideal and it's preferable, it's not necessary to fulfill the commandments. Because that's the bottom line. There are a few commandments. There are a few commandments where kavanah is absolutely necessary in order to fulfill the commandment. But it might be asking too much of the average prayer or of the average Jew to constantly maintain that heightened level of awareness and sensitivity to what they're doing, especially when they're doing something that takes minutes at a time to execute. So although kavanah, intention, dedication, higher awareness is ideal and preferable, it's not required. It makes things a little bit easier for the average Jew to fulfill his obligation. Because if things become too difficult for the average Jew to fulfill their obligation, they will despair and they might do even less, the rabbis fear, than they would otherwise do if they felt like, you know what, most of these commandments, even all of the commandments, are within my reach. The rabbis believed that character is influenced by behavior. The way this is expressed in a medieval text called the Book of Education is the heart is drawn after the deeds. Even if we do things without really having the proper kavanah, without really understanding what we're doing, without linking what we're doing to God, eventually we'll get it and we'll figure it out. So the rabbis, in a very daring midrash, say, have God saying. Very frequently in the midrash, the rabbis play ventriloquist to biblical characters and to God. So in this case, the rabbis are playing ventriloquist to God. So the rabbis have God saying in the midrash, better that the Jews leave me and keep my ways than maintain their belief in me and stop fulfilling the commandments. Because through fulfilling the commandments, they'll eventually be led back to me. Right? A daring midrash in the mouth of the rabbis. I want to conclude this lecture by pointing out that in the Jewish Middle Ages, the mystics maintained that a mitzvah is incomplete. Right? You may technically have fulfilled your obligation, but a mitzvah is incomplete without kavanah or intention because it fails to be maximally transformative, both to the individual and, as we will see when we get to a discussion of the mystic's understanding of the reason behind the commandments, it fails to be maximally transformative to the world and to God, God's self. Okay, so that concludes our discussion of the relationship between law and spirit. We will continue to discuss this theme as we progress through the class, but now we're going to move back into a discussion of the Jewish calendar.